I next met with Dr. Richard Fisher, who did the discussion at the last ASCO meeting of the historic PRIMA study that demonstrated a benefit to 2 years of maintenance rituximab after R-chemo in follicular lymphoma. Dr. Fisher began by providing the background to this trial.
It's been pretty well established now that when you end up treating a patient with follicular lymphoma with chemotherapy, that it should always be with rituximab and chemotherapy. And that's true regardless of what you use. But the question remained whether you should use maintenance after that and whether there was a real benefit versus waiting and then retreating the patient later. And there have been a number of studies that suggested that in relapsed patients, when they were treated, that maintenance had value and prevented further recurrence and at least delayed it significantly. And now the PRIMA study was the most recent study that came out that actually took upfront patients and treated them with R-chemo and ended up randomizing them to maintenance or not and showed a significant, probably 15% or more benefit to having patients receive maintenance rituximab. There's still some controversy about the schedule and the best way to do it. The way they did it was every 2 months for 2 years. Some have used every 3 months before, but that varies and is a little unclear. But in any event, it now appears pretty clear to me that maintenance should be considered in all upfront therapy.
Now, you, of course, gave the discussion at ASCO on that long-awaited paper. And I think a lot of people listened to what you said and came away thinking, just as you just said, that you felt very positively about using this strategy outside a protocol setting. And yet there are other investigators who are far less enthusiastic, saying there's no survival data yet. How have people responded to your comments?
Well, I guess having done this for many, many years, it's not surprising. Some people told me I was too late getting to the conclusion, and some people told me I jumped too early. So I probably got it pretty much right. The group of people that I consistently tend to think alike, we all came to the same conclusion. And really, the issue is that there's no question it delays recurrence. And the question is, what value do you put on that? There is no survival benefit yet. That is true. And that would be nice to see and may well come later on. The issue is, I think you have to put it in the context of all the data that's out there. And the data in relapse was very convincing. Some of them have survival. Some of them have borderline advantages with longer follow-up. This is consistent with getting a survival advantage. If you treat a lot of these patients as we have over the years, I think no one would choose recurrence over being disease-free if the price weren't too high. And so the question is, what's the price? And the price is clearly cost, and that's an issue. The second price is coming back to the doctor's office and getting the treatment, which does remind the patients of their disease. But the real toxicity, as it is defined in terms of heart events, with 2 years of rituximab was pretty minimal. And there were not terrible infections, and we have a pretty good handle on that. I'm not advocating going beyond 2 years, and there are some 4- and 5-year studies. And we'll have to watch them. I think prolonged immunosuppression and absence of B cells will ultimately deplete new antigen reactivity and might have some severe consequences. But it looked pretty reasonable at 2 years. So not everybody agrees, and that's probably not a surprise in follicular lymphoma. But I think with the overwhelming weight of evidence, I'm comfortable now, and I waited till I saw this study. We did not treat patients at Rochester or in SWOG with maintenance, and now we do believe that we should do that.
You know, it's interesting, in the beginning of your discussion, you kind of track back the recent history, particularly over the last 5 years of the disease, and you know, reminded me of something I hadn't thought about for a while, which is for a long time, people thought that maybe you couldn't change the natural history. And I wonder if that's kind of part of some of the conservatism here.
I think that paradigm was put out largely led by the Stanford group many years ago, 20, 25 years ago. And there was a belief by Dr. Rosenberg and others at that time that people were being harmed by chemotherapy. And that was the back off from too much at that time. The recent studies are pretty interesting. I agree entirely with your assessment here. Once rituximab came in and had this pretty remarkable synergy with chemotherapy of almost any type, all of a sudden, when you get a good enough drug, you get a big enough benefit in failure-free or disease-free survival, and then you get a survival benefit. So we have published, and there are a number of other studies, we published the experience in the Southwest Oncology Group. There are now other databases, MD Anderson, Vancouver, the SEER data, which clearly show that survival in follicular lymphomas has improved. And patients are doing much better than they ever did before. And so on many levels, it's hard to think that it isn't the rituximab combination that's made the difference there. And therefore, I think one has to have that in the back of your mind. And actually now, I am prepared to ask the question, I don't know the answer, are we curing some patients? And how long will they stay in remission? And I think we need to get rid of the fact that it doesn't make any difference and they're all going to die the same way, and now move on to seeing if we can move aggressively to improve the results again.
Now, there are different ways to look at data, and it also gets into the question of what you say to patients. You talked about the 15% absolute difference, but the hazard rate was about 50%. So would you say to a patient, your chance of developing a progressive disease or a relapse is going to be reduced 50% over the next few years?
The hazard ratio is an important measure, and we can look at it, and it's important statistically. But I think there's been a lot of effort recently in the last year to move us from statistical significance to biologic significance. So if I tell you that there's a 15% chance you're going to be alive at 5 years more than if you don't do it, I think that's something patients understand and they can relate to.
I have to say, too, that as an observer to this, I found it a little frustrating to see that there was a press release that comes out in September 09 about this with not too much information, but enough that you could say, whoa, I really like to see that data. And yet it's not till June that we get to see that.
You're absolutely correct. This was a very frustrating thing. The story behind the story is that the abstract was planned to go into a late-breaking abstract at ASH. Many of us think that without question, it's the most important abstract to be at least viewed, and certainly with the press release, but the program committee, for whatever reason, didn't choose to select it. So it never got presented. So we had this very difficult situation where a press release without enough information to act on it was out, and it was a year later till we saw the data. Now, I'm pleased to say that I personally, as you know, think the data supports what was said in the press release and is good, but that was a very hard time, and it puts everyone in an awkward position. So I would have preferred that it had been all together or not at all, obviously.
So I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Rummel at ASCO, and you talked about duration of maintenance. And of course, the German group had already launched a study looking at 4 years versus two. Any speculations or any data out there, both in terms of potential efficacy with longer therapy and toxicity?
So I'd like to go back to basic principles. I've rarely been disappointed when the data and the concepts fit the basic principles. I've rarely been wrong. And so the basic principle that I'm going to talk about here is that prolonged immunosuppression for any reason is never good. It's always bad in any model. It wasn't a surprise to me or others when the HIV-positive patients got lymphomas. It isn't a surprise that the congenital immunodeficiencies get lymphomas. It isn't a surprise that the long-time immunosuppressed transplants get lymphomas. So as a fundamental biologic principle, very prolonged important immunosuppression is difficult. Rituximab has been very interesting. It's taken out the B cells, the mature B cells, but the patients haven't suffered. That's been a great thing. And the reason probably is that it doesn't take out the memory compartment. It takes out the B cells that would respond to new antigens. And so in theory, you have enough repertoire from your adult status, which most of these people do, that they're fine for the time period that they're getting the rituximab. Now, that doesn't say that if you take out the new antigen-initiating response cell forever, that there won't be some antigens that come along that need an immune response that are going to get you in trouble. We are beginning to see some immunodeficiency in terms of immunoglobulin levels in long, retreated, heavily treated patients with rituximab. And it's persistent. And some of those patients are developing significant sinopulmonary infections that are clearly up in incidence. So I think you just have to be cautious. I joked originally once as a bad joke that it was the next fluoride and would go in the water supply because it would help everybody, but that's clearly not true. So I don't know whether 4 will be okay. I think the data on 2 looks pretty good. I'm going to be very cautious before I adopt 4 and 5 in that regard.
I think oncologists in practice who have already lived through over the last 10, 20 years, the whole story of duration of endocrine therapy in breast cancer and how they start out using a year of tamoxifen, then 2 years, then 5, and now you see trials looking at 10 years, or maybe cautiously optimistic that the same kind of story might play out in terms of maintenance. Are any guesses about whether more prolonged therapy will reduce the relapse rate?
My guess is that there's an inflection point and a tipping point, and that there is a number that is the best optimal number, and that beyond that, toxicity will overcome it. I don't know what that point is. If you push me wildly, I'm going to be very concerned about the 5-year point, but I can't go beyond that.
One of the slides you showed in your presentation was the design of the so-called resort trial, the ECOG study that Brad Kahl is running. Can you talk a little bit about what they're looking at? And I know, having talked to Dr. Kahl, one of the main interests there is to try to look at translational components. Any predictions about what we might learn in the future about how we can predict who's going to benefit from this treatment?
So the resort trial really stems from some early work out of Tennessee, where basically in a small, underpowered study, the concept was raised that you did as well if after your treatment you waited until you relapsed and then you got retreated, because we all know that you can use rituximab multiple times. So the question was the benefit of maintenance versus just waiting. Psychological, social implications, cost implications, all kinds of other complicated things. That's the question. And that's really what's being asked in the resort trial, which is what's the actual, in enough patients with enough power to really know, what's the result of waiting till relapse and retreating versus otherwise? I don't know what that's going to show. If you push me to make a prediction, I think it's going to show that maintenance is superior. But that's my bias. That's not based on hard data. And certainly I think the trial is a wonderful trial and needs to be done. My own bias is that the biologic correlates that we have probably not got enough key leads that it's likely we're going to answer the biologic questions that are being asked. I think we're more in discovery than we are in hypothesis-driven testing. And I wish we could target or predict who's going to do well in one versus another. I think that's not going to be simple. But again, you know, could be surprised. There's just not enough known about rituximab responsiveness that segregates easily into big differences that allows me to think that we're going to take groups and treat them that differently at this point. But we'll see.
Now, another strategy that's kind of out on the table in the same space, so to speak, is radioimmune therapy consolidation. What do we know about that, and any way to indirectly compare the benefits of that versus our maintenance?
So we should have this discussion a year from now, and I'm hopeful that we will have a definitive answer. I've done a lot of work with radioimmunotherapy, as you know, and we have an ongoing cooperative intergroup trial, S0016, which is compared CHOP rituximab in the standard fashion with CHOP followed by the Bexxar or radioimmunotherapy, one of the two products. That trial has hundreds of patients on it. It is maturing, and we promise that we will have an abstract by ASCO of next year. I don't even know yet what the results of that are because it's blinded in this country very carefully by the DMSB, but I think that will be a pivotal study on kind of a make or break. Radioimmunotherapy has been slow to take off in popularity, a lot of reasons for that, but it's a very active agent. I think it clearly has a role in these patients. And obviously our pilot data, which led to this randomized comparison, was very optimistic in the original studies led by Ali Press for the Southwest Oncology Group. We had very good results at 5 years and hundreds of patients nationally. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. I say that not because I'm invested in the radioimmunotherapy, but obviously we hope that the new therapy is always better or we wouldn't be testing it. So we're looking forward to seeing that, and then we'll have to decide where we go from there.
Do you think that radioimmunotherapy as consolidation is an option right now that should be presented to patients off study?
In general, no. If they're in complete remission or have a good response, I think they should go on to rituximab maintenance now. I wouldn't replace it. In the relapse setting, radioimmunotherapy has indication. In some of the transformation settings, it has indication. We saw a relapse post an autologous transplant this week we discussed in our Rochester Lymphoma Conference, where there was a localized transformation and the patient had had prior chemo and transplant. And so an induction with some chemo followed by radioimmunotherapy made a lot of sense. Lots of places it can be used, but I wouldn't use it routinely in the average patient after induction first therapy.
What about radioimmunotherapy up front? I remember interviewing Mark Kaminsky a while back, and he presented an update of his data from Michigan at ASH last year.
Not much. Mark ran the longest trial at Michigan, kind of a single institution experience. It's published in the New England Journal. Looked pretty good. Frankly, didn't look as good to me as the combined therapy in our pilots with chemo plus RIT, but, you know, it's apples and oranges a bit, different selection criteria, et cetera. So there's not much new in that alone. I think radioimmunotherapy is in danger of disappearing if these studies aren't positive soon. Products have been sold, companies are, you know, bottom lines are coming in, and it's not clear how long they're going to go. So I think it's very active. Most people who have worked with it know that it's active. We'd like to see it around, and hopefully, therefore, we can show some benefit. But within a year, we'll know the answer to that.
You know, even for relapse disease, as an observer, I've just been watching this for years now and not exactly understanding it. I'm not sure I can think of any other area of oncology where you have a therapy of proven benefit. You talk to investigators, they say it's great, and it's not used, and you say why? Well, it has to do with practical reasons. I mean, is that your take?
It's been a difficult sell to the world. As you say, I don't know of a single investigator who's used it who doesn't think it's good. Some of us on a given day can say it's as active as anything else we've seen. It requires a team approach. It requires the inclusion of people who traditionally don't participate in active patient care as opposed to diagnostics, namely your nuclear medicine. I often joke that if the iodine license and things were in the hands of the radiation oncologists, it would have been much wider used and picked up in that regard. So lots of reasons. There is toxicity from it. It's a little scary if you're not used to thinking about it and know what you're doing. And it just hasn't gone very far. It will have to be data-driven for this to work. There's no question about that.
And I was going to bring up the relative lack of toxicity also. What specifically have you observed in terms of side effects and toxicity?
Well, my patients who go through radioimmunotherapy come out and say, you know, my goodness, there's no comparison to chemotherapy. It's just without question, or radiation oncology, by the way, radiation therapy at high doses. There's no question that patients prefer the radioimmunotherapy. There's a little fatigue at the time. Usually the worst thing is that fatigue. There is cytopenias, but again, the biologic model, since radioimmunotherapy doesn't target the gut, you don't have a leaky bowel syndrome of dividing cells being killed in the gut as you do with chemotherapy. And therefore, what you find out is that the patients tolerate these low counts and rarely get infected. Now, the big worry, of course, is the myelodysplasia. There is some. It is mostly in the heavily pretreated patients where there are multiple insults from other agents. People are getting wiser and looking at that and frequently doing, you know, some abnormality studies to look beforehand to see if there's a predilection. There'll be some. But if the benefit is as good as it may be, that probably won't be a limiting factor. So, you know, we'll just have to see this data.
So let's talk about some of the new research inroads or strategies that are being looked at in FL. And I mentioned Dr. Rummel before, and I'm curious about your take on the bendamustine rituximab study, the German study that he first reported at ASH.
So, you know, bendamustine is the new wonder drug, and it is an amazingly active drug. You can argue about predictions, but I don't think anybody in the West predicted this drug would have that kind of activity, alkylating and purine analog combined. Why it works the way it works, not clear, but it's very active, okay? And these drug developments are all the product of the economies and the worlds they live in, and obviously East Germany was a tough place to develop drugs, and so it's taken a long time, et cetera. The studies now look good, and I think it's very active, and we use it significantly. I am not ready to jump on the comparison yet that says that it should be replacing R-CHOP in the treatment of these patients, R-bendamustine. There is some data that suggests that out of this one study. It's not published. We don't have a lot of knowledge of how the statistics were done, how the follow-ups were done. It's a new group that this is their first endeavor in the national, international spotlight. And so I think it's interesting and worthy of thinking about, particularly when there are contraindications to CHOP chemotherapy. A lot of people have decided to go with it, but I think it's not the right thing yet to abandon the standard based on that one study in the current time.
So I'm curious to refine down a little bit more your thoughts about it. Let's say you're seeing a person in a second opinion, healthy 60-year-old person who's got an indication to treat, and comes into you and the first doc has recommended BR. Do you say, I really don't think you should do it. I think you should take R-CHOP. Do you say that's a reasonable option? If you want to do it, it's okay, but it's not what I prefer. Or how would you shade it?
The second is how I shade it. I think it is a reasonable option. I think it'd be inappropriate to say it shouldn't be used. On the other hand, they're coming to me as an expert for a second opinion, and I think they have a right to know that we don't do that in our center, except when there's a problem, very elderly cardiac problems, neuro problems that make it impossible to give our chemo. So we don't use it as the standard, but we do use it, and that's the way I would phrase that.
What have you observed in the patients who you actually treated with BR in terms of quality of life, for example, compared to R-CHOP?
Well, the toxicity profile is a bit different. You know, there's not much hair loss. There is still marrow toxicity. There still can be pretty significant fatigue, especially depending on the combinations that are used. The data from Rumble suggests that it's significantly less toxic, and that may be true, but it's not non-toxic. And so we haven't treated a lot of people who are fully performance status able, in great health, to know how it compares. So we're using it in a pre-selected population that almost by definition is less healthy. And that makes that comparison, I think, hard for me to make. I don't have side by side if you or I had to take it and see what we would do. So I think my database is skewed against it because I'm doing it in the lesser healthy people.
Any thoughts about the appropriate dose of bendamustine, both in the upfront setting as well as the progressive or recurrent disease setting?
Well, it's a little unclear. There's been some controversy. There's some different studies. I think the dose has been 90 milligrams per meter squared times 2 days is basically what we use. When you get into some of the combinations, you got to get closer to 60 to avoid the toxicity. Again, in these drugs that have come up over many years with kind of happenstance more than pre-planned drug development, there isn't as good work on the phase one, phase two schedule sequence, et cetera. So I think probably you can get away with most upfront at 90, but you will get excess toxicity in some, and 60 is probably the combination dose.
Now, within SWOG, are you all planning a new upfront study? And if so, what are you thinking about? And does BR come in the discussion in terms of control arm or how you're going to factor that in?
So we're about a year away from the results of our big phase three. At the current time, we are running a phase two that tries to build on the CHOP-BEXAR study by interdigitating rituximab in it. So we give rituximab for the first four cycles. We stop to allow some clearance and washout because there is some laboratory data and clinical question of whether rituximab binding will then obviate the effects of BEXAR if you give it. We then give the BEXAR, and then we're giving them maintenance therapy with rituximab. So I can't say what we're going to do. If CHOP Bexar alone turns out to be the winner of that phase 3 study, and this phase 2 looks promising, I think you might see that arm obviously as one of the things to expand on. If R-CHOP is as good or CHOP Bexar doesn't make it, then I think we're closer to a discussion of bendamustine. But now in the new world of studies with steering committees run by the NCI, we're going to have a lot of complicated discussion before this one comes to a new study.
I know one strategy that's been looked at and has been discussed is a combination of bendamustine, rituximab, and bortezomib. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, and Jonathan Friedberg at our institution has done a version of that. There are several versions, a little bit different.
Right.
They have good activity, as you would expect. They are toxic and not trivial. You probably narrow the gap between R-CHOP and bendamustine rituximab, bortezomib in. And the question is what the contribution of bortezomib is going to make, and you really need to see the randomized study to address that question. I was part of the process, as you probably know, in the Pinnacle study of getting bortezomib approved in mantle cell. I'm not quite as confident that it's going to make a major addition in follicular, but the data will show.
What about the role of bortezomib outside a protocol setting with a progressive follicular lymphoma by itself? Do you use it?
Quite honestly, not very often. There are so many options in follicular lymphoma right now. And there's such a crowded field for us in an academic center with new things that are coming along that we have a SPOR at Rochester with Arizona and Virginia that I run. And we are developing new strategies there. So we have a lot of developmental things that come in that we're testing our patients on. So I think we haven't felt compelled to use single-agent bortezomib in the relapse setting.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about lenalidomide in the treatment of FL?
Yeah, this is, again, a fascinating enigma. I wish I knew how lenalidomide worked. I wish I knew how rituximab worked, actually. It is very different pathways. Multiple things are affected by its activity. It does seem to have some reasonable duration of maintenance, and questions are being asked in a variety of studies about lenalidomide and whether it will work in maintenance and how well it'll do and whether it should be combined with rituximab, of course, et cetera. So we use it. We use it, of course, a lot in mantle cell. We use it a bit in follicular. It's one of these agents that I think we're going to have some coming together to try and seek the ultimate best way to use it. I think we don't know where and when to use it optimally now.
Let's talk a little bit about mantle cell and, again, things that have happened over the past year. And maybe to start out, I'm curious, you mentioned Dr. Friedberg, and he did a presentation in ASH, I guess sort of representing the NCCN, looking at how patients within the NCCN were treated for mantle cell. Can you talk about what was seen there and overall where we are right now with mantle cell?
It's all over the map. There are enormous variations in mantle cell. And I think, again, we need to come together and try and figure out what the best way to go. R-CHOP is the standard, although some people will yell it's so bad it shouldn't be the standard. I'm not far from that. Hyper-CVAD with R, of course, is a very toxic regimen and not applicable to many of the elderly who get this disease, at least in its full format. Data suggests that patients do benefit from transplant if they can get a good, clean remission going into the autologous transplant. Bendamustine rituximab floats around and says it's an easy way maybe to get some of the patients there. There's a lot going on. There's no single standard. We're getting ready to do an intergroup study in which we're trying to make a hybrid that can be a standard for moving it forward. We're going to use a short course probably of hyper-CVAD, not the 8, but probably 4. And then we're going to follow it by a stem cell transplant if they get a good result. And then we're talking about a variety of maintenance. And we're going to compare that probably, at least in a phase 2 setting, randomized phase 2 setting, to a bendamustine rituximab induction, following that potentially by transplant, again, with maybe a maintenance question or not. So there are a lot of questions out there. The other thing that's become clear which was the Europeans and Germans have talked about a long time, and the problem is picking these people, is that there are a few people who do well without treatment for a fair bit of time. That seems to be clear from them, but how you figure out who they are is not so clear. And I personally have several patients going now, a year, 2 years, with minimal disease. That seems to be the criteria I'm coming out to. I don't want to postulate that as a great scientific finding, but patients who come in with resected disease or an endoscopy that shows minimal disease in the colon, we've been able to sit on these people for a while. And hopefully as therapy gets better, we can offer them something potentially curative, and hopefully they don't mutate spontaneously to drug resistance while we're waiting.
If we compare an otherwise healthy 60-year-old to an 80-year-old who requires treatment for mantle cell, what's a patient like that likely to receive from you outside a protocol setting?
Well, I think we won't even consider our hyper-CVAD in the 80-year-old. It's just off the table. It's way too toxic. And so, you know, we're going to be looking at our Benda or our CHOP to see how they tolerate it. We now have built in a geriatric assessment clinic at Rochester, and we have some assistance now in predicting how well these very elderly new patients to the clinical trial and the clinical treatment programs are going to do. So we look at that, and then we try to make an assessment. I do believe, in general, that you go full dose on the initial cycle if you think you can do it, and then modify after that. So we try not to prejudge and cut doses. If we don't think the patient will tolerate the regimen, we don't go in, but we look for something we can give at full dose as opposed to going half dose.
How about the healthy 60-year-old?
Well, the healthy 60-year-old now, we're looking at thinking about a transplant on top of a consolidation regimen, and the question is, what's the best way to get them to that consolidation regimen?
Is there sort of an absolute age in an otherwise completely healthy, fit person where you won't do transplant? You said 80 is too old. You know, what's the oldest you would consider?
And I'm sure some of my transplant colleagues will jump up and down about that. We're kind of cut off around early 70s, 75s kind of pushing it for us. Of course, there are exceptions. But you got to have a good reason to transplant someone in the latter half of the seventh group.
We talked about maintenance R for indolent lymphoma. What about maintenance R in mantle cell? What do we know about it, and what do you do in your own practice?
We know less. We really don't know if there's a good role there. Some data suggesting there is, a bit unclear. I guess we're, because of the weight of the evidence and everything, leaning more toward doing it on some schedule. But it's hard to find. We can't find the right induction regimen. We could do into transplant. Then when we do more than that, we don't know exactly what we're doing. So we're cautious.
You mentioned the use of bortezomib in mantle cell. What's the usual situation where you utilize the drug, and how do you approach the schedule? There's been discussion in terms of weekly versus biweekly.
We still use it in the relapse indication. Unfortunately, these patients do relapse. And we use the schedule that was in the Pinnacle, which is, you know, twice a week for 2 weeks out of three. And that's the way we do it if we're doing it in a single agent and try and make it as data-driven as we can.
With that type of approach, what do you see in terms of neuropathy and how do you manage that?
The neuropathy, depending on what they had before, obviously, and depending on the age, can be a problem. And it does require you to periodically cut back and slow down. But I think you can monitor it pretty well. We haven't yet, fortunately, had catastrophic neurologic injury from this at this point.
What's being looked at or considered in terms of bringing bortezomib into upfront therapy for mantle cell?
Well, there are a variety of studies. It's not the easiest drug to put into all of the combinations. People have worked on the R-CHOP with it. There's some data of how you can do that. There's going to be bendamustine bortezomib, I'm sure. It's pretty much still in the developmental phase at the moment.
What about diffuse large B-cell? Anything that's come out over this past year that you think docs in practice should know about? We get a lot of questions about interim PET scanning.
Yeah, interim PET scanning is the new wave that may ultimately help us or hurt us. I'm not convinced yet. If the question is it better to be negative in an interim PET scan than to be positive, it's an easy question. of course you want to be negative. My favorite teaching is just because you have a problem doesn't mean you know what to do about it. And so for the patient who has a positive PET scan, some of those will convert to negative at the end. And there is now some data, some people arguing that the end of cycle PET scan is actually better prediction or not. We don't have good prospective data on this. I am concerned about people giving a couple cycles of R-CHOP and taking a positive PET scan, hopefully really positive, because there are issues about false positives, and then moving on to do what? I guess the knee-jerk response is take them off and do a transplant. The data in the world suggests overwhelmingly, and I've reviewed this extensively, that transplant early before a full course of chemotherapy, when you don't have a really good response, is not going to work very well. So I know there's a problem, and if you got, you know, some great regimen that you think is as good as an alternative, that would be a time to use it, but there isn't such a thing right now. So we try not to make decisions on at least the advanced stage patients off protocol based on an interim PET. That's different than obviously clinical progressive disease, in which case, of course, we would stop therapy and do something else.